This ESPN Radio Daily Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. To get a free quote on car insurance, call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE or visit progressive.com. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive. This is the ESPN Radio Daily Podcast.
This man is the biggest star in television.
He is.
He's Mel Kiper Jr. on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Hi, Mel.
We know that's not true, guys.
Well, we talked on Friday morning, and the big story then was the quarterbacks that went on Thursday and those that did not. What did you think of where Clawson and McCoy wound up ultimately?
I think they were patient. They obviously, money-wise, it affects you if you're not a first-round pick. But I think at the end of the day, they're going to be very happy with where they landed. And I think ultimately, 3-4 years down the road, this should be a good scenario for Clawson at Carolina. Certainly, it should be for Colt McCoy. They know that they're going to allow him to watch and learn his rookie year, and then by year two, year three, he'll be a factor. So it couldn't have worked out any better. I was screaming, if you remember, about Cleveland taking him at 38. Well, they took him at 85. So, I said at 38 when he's there, you take him. But Mike Holmgren, I'll tell you, had incredible patience. Do you imagine to take a T.J. Ward, a safety out of Oregon, who I thought was a major reach at that point, then come back and take a running back out of Tennessee, Hardesty, and then at 85, I don't know if they just felt like we have other quarterbacks late that we like, that we can live with, that McCoy was kind of in a group, that if we get one of these guys, and you remember Matt Hasselbeck was a late round pick, so he's one with other quarterbacks. Favre wasn't a first round pick, and of course they inherited him after the trade, but I just think it just worked out perfectly for both those kids. Now, if you look at Dan LeFevre even going to Chicago in round six, I mean, there's a kid that's got a chance to be a quarterback 3 or 4 years down the road in the NFL.
Anywhere, earlier with Jimmy Clawson, I mean, still there's a lot of surprise. Yeah. He didn't go in the first round. Did you see any spots where he could have gone?
Mike, the speculation, and Mort had brought this up, and Adam Schefter had talked about Seattle. I know Mort thought that Seattle would not have seen Earl Thomas, the safety from Texas, on the board at that point. And we all thought Philadelphia at 13, once they traded up, would look at Earl Thomas. Well, they opted for Brandon Graham. Had they taken Earl Thomas, Mort speculated, that Seattle would have taken Jimmy Clawson at 14. So that's the fine line. And interestingly enough, Seattle was up again at pick 60. So had Carolina not taken Clawson at 48, would Clawson have fallen to 60 for Seattle to get at that point when they were considering him at 14? Go imagine almost take a kid at 14 and then get him at 60. So just worked out that in between Carolina, that was their first pick overall. They had traded away their one last year to get Everett Brown. Their pick was traded away. So they end up, instead of thinking, okay, we lost Clawson because we gave that first round pick up, now he falls to them. It's amazing how it's worked for these quarterbacks over the years.
All right, Mike and Mike in the unmistakable voice of Mel Kiper. So let's, looking back on it, and everyone can see your grades on ESPN.com, but let's get your thoughts. Two or three teams that you thought had the very best weekends.
Well, I like Seattle. I think to make the moves to get the two running backs and then to get the players they did via the draft on offense and defense. Pete Carroll went with familiarity, a lot of Pac-10 guys, got his USC, did everything he could, with Lindale White coming back, Leon Washington. So they, I think, as long as Whitehurst or Hasselbeck, as long as the quarterback that they feel they have the right guy there, they're going to be in good shape. And the Baltimore Ravens, to move out of the first round once Dez Bryant was taken by Dallas after the Dallas traded up to get him, to get the players they did. I mean, they say, well, they didn't get a corner, they didn't get a safety. Well, you can't get everything. I mean, they got a defense, a nose tackle, they got a linebacker just because they were the best players on the board. And then they got the two tight ends, the wide receiver David Reed and the offensive guard Ramon Harewood, in addition to Arthur Jones from Syracuse at defensive tackle. So I don't think you can argue with any player they got at the point in which they came off the board. The only thing you can say negative about the Ravens, they didn't get a corner or safety. And as I said, you don't have 12, 15 picks anymore like teams used to in a 12-round draft. So you can't do it all in a 7-round draft. And I think for what the Ravens had, without even having a first-round pick after trading out, they in Seattle, by far, to me, had the two best drafts.
And for the record, John Harbaugh said over the weekend also that he had spoken to Ed Reed and emerged encouraged that Reed is going to come back.
Right.
Remember, there's been talk about it every time,
right,
so they wouldn't have the needed safety if Reed is still there.
I thought they showed some really good patience in drafting, in going back a little bit and going for the value. Did a nice job. So if you're talking about a couple on the good side, let's talk about a couple on the bad side as well.
Well, I think when you look at the Jacksonville Jaguars, I mean, yeah, I know Tyson Alualu is a good player. I just think you at 10, I know Spiller was gone one pick ahead. Maybe Spiller was the guy they would have been looking at. But, you know, you got to get value. You can't – 7th best player at 10, you normally think you can get. You know, people say, well, you're picking 10th, get the 10th best player. It normally never works out that way. Usually it's the 6th, 7th best player on your board. And while I like Tyson Alualu, nobody's going to ever convince me he's a 6th or 7th best player. He's a late one. You know, and the thing I don't get there, guys, is, you know, people say you can't trade down. Well, the two teams after them did. You know, why can't you move out of 10? Are you fearful he's going to go at 12, 13, 14, 15? I didn't talk to anybody that had him that high. So everybody I spoke to said at earliest late one. So that kind of surprised me. And then also what they did in round three, taking, you know, DeAnthony Smith. You don't beat teams up for a third round pick. But at that particular point in the third round, they needed a safety. And there were two safeties, ironically, that went the pick after that. Chicago took Major Wright. Giants took Chad Jones, and I thought Darryl Stuckey, who went to San Diego in the fourth, was a nice safety. So three very good safeties, the position they needed help, were on the board in round three. They take another defensive lineman, a guy in DeAnthony Smith, I thought was a slight reach even at that point. So, we'll see. I mean, they might, Jacksonville could come out saying, hey, 2-3 years from now, you idiots that criticized our draft, we showed you. So, hey, it's an opinion. It's not fact. It's fact. It's just an opinion. We don't know fact until 3 or 4 years down the road. So, but Jacksonville, to me, was the one question mark.
Teams that kind of get lost in the shuffle are teams that don't have a first-round pick, and in some cases not a first- or second-round pick because there's not the you lose that big name value. So for a team like the Bears, who didn't pick till the 75th pick in the third round, how did a team like that fare?
Very, very well. And interestingly enough, the teams that didn't have the ones. Now, Minnesota, you know, moved out. And I'm not a Chris Cook, I think, was a little overrated, the corner out of Virginia. Todd McShay really liked Cook. So we'll see about that down the road. I think Toby Gerhart had even a better receiver. That's what they needed to make up for Chester Taylor's loss. So I question them. But for the Bears, Mike, I think they did very well. Major Wright's a nice player. I thought he could be an early two. Corey Wooten would have been a one had he not had that knee injury in that bowl game. And, of course, this year it's a kind of a lackluster year. But you're right off a knee injury. So now 2 years removed, he should be back to his old form. Joshua Moore, the cornerback out of Kansas State, to get Lefevre. They got the huge tackle Webb out of West Texas A&M. So for a team that only brought 5 players into the fold, didn't pick till the third round, I don't think Bear fans can be upset at all. I gave them a B grade, and I think they did a solid job.
Mike, again, you can see all of Mel's grades on ESPN.com. He also already has his top 10 picks for next year, or a top 10 prospects.
Hey, Greeny,
yeah.
There'll be 25 of them up next Wednesday.
You know what? The more, the merrier,
hey,
my
and
friend.
By the way, you'll love this. McShay, Todd's got a first-round projection going up on ESPN.com for next year's draft.
Really? Who does he have the Jets taking 32nd?
Yeah.
32nd. That was nice, Greeny. Stick that in there.
Every once in a while, I get a line in. Mike and Mel is with us. Just looking at your grades from this year, I'm looking at the names that are at the bottom. So working back from the bottom, Jacksonville you have at the very bottom. Then the next group is Atlanta, Minnesota, Washington, Denver. Those are the teams whose drafts really did not strike you. Is there a common theme? Is there something that you saw there amongst the teams that you liked the least that sort of was a commonality, draft board, that kind of thing?
Well, it wasn't. They weren't bad. They were just some things. Denver just trying to go they went 3 steps backward with players they let go. And I'm not a Cutler guy, but you got to make up for that somehow, okay? And certainly with Brandon Marshall, great play. You go 3 steps backward. Now you're just hoping to get the even. And you're hoping to get the even with unknowns. And that bothers me a little bit. I think when you look at it overall in terms of some of the grades that were given out, you look at Minnesota, I talked about that. Even Denver, I like Eric Decker a lot. I think Eric Decker is a third-round pick. If Tim Tebow is going to be the quarterback 3 years down the road, he'll need Eric Decker to be the kind of receiver I think he can be. Atlanta, they got Weatherspoon, nice pick at outside linebacker, but not enough wow factor thereafter. And for the Redskins, I'll say this, guys. Trent Williams over Russell Okung, hey, you're splitting hairs there. They're both very good players. Chris Forster is the offensive line coach with the Redskins. If there's an assistant coach in the NFL, we all talk about the head coaches. If there's an assistant coach that's kind of on the spot to really earn that paycheck, Chris Forster is a guy to really watch and see how that offensive line at Washington develops, because if McNabb elevates them to a 10-win team or whatever, it's because Chris Forster did one heck of a job. So he's an offensive line coach that has a chance now to take a makeshift group with a rookie left tackle, put it together so the Redskins can kind of catapult into at least the discussion for the playoffs from down at the bottom where they have been.
Another great weekend, another great NFL draft come and gone. It's always fun with Mel Kiper. Thank you, Mel. That's terrific work as always.
You got it, guys. Appreciate it, man.
compare car insurance rates from top insurers in one easy place. Visit Progressive.com today. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive.
ESPN.com senior NFL writer John Clayton. John, before we get to that, let's start with Tim Tebow here. Now that he's a Bronco, and Josh McDaniels says he's going to be a quarterback only. This was big news on Sunday night. I've said on the show tonight, I think drafting a quarterback, drafting Tebow is like drafting a quarterback as the number one overall pick. The pressure for him to play is going to be immense. I think he has to play, and he has to play soon because of everything around him. What do you think?
I think it's a big mistake. I mean, I'm debating whether they should have moved into the first round because I think that it's the wrong place, the wrong time, all those different things. But see, here's the other problem that I think is underlying. You know, Tebow is a left-handed quarterback. I mean, that's not his fault. He was born that way. So now, if you make a dramatic change, you've now neutralized one of the best young left tackles in the game, Ryan Clady, you know, because, you know, Clady is a right hand, you know, for a right-handed quarterback, is protecting the blind side. So unless you move him over to right tackle, which is unlikely, he's going to be then devalued because he's the equivalent of a right tackle. So now one of the best young blockers in the league is neutralized. And so, you know, moving Tebow in, moving him out, it creates a problem there. And then secondly, how do you know that Tebow is really ready? I mean, obviously they'll play him in the preseason games and try to do those different things. You know, they have Kyle Wharton for another year. But which quarterback do you think gives them the better chance to win now? And I think the answer is going to be Kyle Wharton. So I think that Tebow's pretty well going to be stashed most of this year. And the debate's going to be, do you have him as the backup quarterback or do you have Brady Quinn as the backup quarterback? And where I say it's not a good fit, this is John Elway's city. The standard is John Elway. Do you think that Tim Tebow can compare athletically, throwing-wise, to John Elway? I don't think so.
Well, I look at it from this perspective, too, John. You're a team that's trying to convince your fan base your plan to win is correct. You said a year ago the reason you did the Jay Cutler deal was because of Kyle Lorton. Then a couple months ago, we're going to bring in Brady Quinn. And now we're going to draft Tim Tebow with a need pick in the first round when you have to get a starter who's going to be able to play for the next 3 or 4 years. I just don't know that the Broncos' plan is a good one.
Oh, I agree 100% because, you know, if the idea is that you're going to keep changing quarterbacks and go for the next guy, and see, and that's the problem that I have with a coach-driven decision-making operation because, you know, coaches obviously are thinking for the next day, the next, not thinking in the grand scheme of things. And so, you know, first it goes, he takes the job, and the next thing you know, he's thinking, ooh, I can get Matt Cassel? Let me think about that. Not thinking of the ramifications. You know, this is a bright young coach. I mean, he really is bright, but also too, I think in some ways he's naive to some of the realities in the National Football League. And so if you think about trading for Matt Cassel and don't run it by Jay Cutler, then he's going to get mad. Jay Cutler's gone. Brandon Marshall's gone. You know, Ryan Clady's now potentially going to be devalued, and you're now starting to go, you know, next year's quarterback, quarterback after that, and all it's going to lead to is defeats.
ESPN.com senior NFL writer John Clayton is with us. It's All Night with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. We are presented by Progressive Insurance. Now, as far as making changes go, John, that brings us to the New York Jets, who in over the course of the weekend said goodbye to a couple more veterans. They trade Leon Washington. They draft Joe McKnight. They let Alan Faneca go, a right guard who a left guard who may wind up in the Hall of Fame one day. He says on Sunday he's not happy with the way the Jets are going to unproven guys. Now, you saw the moves the Jets have made this offseason. What do you think of everything they've done?
I agree. I mean, listen, I think they made a lot of good moves. I mean, it's certainly getting Antonio Cromartie, going outside and getting Santonio Holmes. I mean, fantastic moves. You've got to like those things. But the problem that I have is now that they're tinkering with one of the successful formulas of this team, running the football. So now I ask you this, Jason, are you better as a running unit with Thomas Jones, Leon Washington, and Sean Green? Or are you better with LaDainian Tomlinson, Sean Green, and then a rookie in Joe McKnight? And I think that takes a step back. Are you better with Vladimir Dukas at the left guard position or Alan Faneca? We can say that maybe Faneca is starting to wear down. As the season goes on, you know, he may not be as effective as he is at the beginning of the season. But the one thing that he gives and Thomas Jones gave is leadership to that offense, and a leadership that helped make DeBrickashaw Ferguson one of the better young left tackles in the league. I mean, you notice DeBrickashaw had his two best years with Faneca by his side. This is going to drop off a little bit now if he has to start breaking in Vladimir Dukas. To me, They take step forward, but now they take step backwards.
See, I look at Faneca this way, John. You know when I knew he was in trouble was, go back to the Charger playoff game. When the Jets were facing fourth and one that was going to either win the game or give the ball back to the Chargers in the final 2 minutes, and the stands are going crazy, the Chargers are sensing comeback, fourth and one wins it. They run Thomas Jones. Where did they run him? They ran him over Damian Woody and Brandon Moore. They didn't go Faneca to Brickashaw Ferguson, and that told me, you're not running behind Alan Faneca, then he's slowing down a little bit, because this is, that's the guy you're supposed to run behind. So I always kind of knew that they weren't as behind him as you think they would be. And, you know, I take a look at the Jets and say they're deciding we're going to get out on a lot of guys and not get stuck in the middle of the season with, boy, this guy's got nothing left in the tank, because you have Leon Washington's injury. You have Thomas Jones had nothing left for the last 8-9 weeks. I just think they're saying, okay, let's cut it short here before we wind up, you know, week 8 and say, oh, boy, these guys are all out of gas.
Sure, I mean, that's fair, and I do think that, you know, Faneca in the last two seasons toward the end has struggled. I don't think there's any question about that. But also, too, you know, he is a leader on that offensive line, and he's made the whole unit better, and I think you lose a little bit of that. You know, at some point, you got to replace him, and I think that, you know, getting Dukas in the second round, great. I mean, now you got a guy that can come in, step in, and replace him. But still, the problem I have is that, you know, you take away a chemistry that has worked so well for this team. And also, too, at a big cost, and when you think that he has to pay $5.25 million on a guarantee that he's not going to be with the team, I just think it's a debatable thing. I mean, it's like, you know, you don't know if they're necessarily getting better. I think that certainly the Santonio Holmes move gets them better, and getting Cromartie, and, you know, they get a cornerback in the first round. All those things worked out, but now they're tinkering with the offense when it doesn't need to be tinkered with.
All right, John, speaking of the Jets, as they made that deal, Leon Washington goes to the Seattle Seahawks. Seattle remakes their running game in one fell swoop. Lendale White, Leon Washington, still Justin Forsett, who looked really good at times last year. They're able to get Russell Okung in the first round. What do you make of Pete Carroll's first draft plus at the helm of the Seahawks?
A-plus. I mean, he had the best draft of anybody because he got 12 players, three veterans, including an entire backfield. You know, he was able to then go ahead and, you know, he's now got the quick back in Leon Washington, the power back in Lendale White, and then gets a left tackle in Russell Okung, gets a safety in Earl Thomas. Cam Chancellor is another safety that very well could be starting by the middle of the season. They get a defensive end in E.J. Wilson, C.J. Wilson that can come in there, maybe start at left end, and then the steal of the draft for them, I think, is getting Golden Tate in the second round, because they had a first round grade on him, and I think that, you know, whether he works a slot, works a flanker, you know, he can give them some good things. So they came out of this with maybe 5-6 starters, which is remarkable. I mean, they were hoping maybe to get 8, but to think that you put that plan in place and, hey, if you come back with 4, you're in good shape. But to come up and get maybe 6 starters, that's huge.
Can Mike Holmgren stick to no Colt McCoy in 2010?
I think he can, because he said it, and I think he's going to do it, and I think that's the wise thing to do. I mean, he did make 2 moves on quarterbacks that are veterans, and he needs to get them on the field in Jake Delhomme and Seneca Wallace. Those are going to be the 2 guys that are going to take this offense, and it gives him a chance for Colt to try to, you know, break in nice and slow and do it the right way, not rush him, not put him through the things that both Derek Anderson and Brady Quinn went through. You know, one thing, you know, when it comes to quarterbacks, you just simply got to trust Mike Holmgren. He knows what he's doing. Now, again, we'll judge if he was the right quarterback selection in Colt McCoy down the line. But once he gets a quarterback, I don't know if there's very he's among the best in figuring out what to do with him. So if his idea is to sit him, it's the right thing to do. Next year he can kind of surface and see where he is in the competition. But I think too many times in this league, you take a quarterback, you rush a quarterback, and the next thing you know, that quarterback is gone. In this case, at least he buys a year to learn a very complex offense.
John, in your mind, why did Clawson and McCoy slide so far?
I'm baffled. I'm not baffled on McCoy, because I think most people had a third round grade on him. And so I think that, you know, he doesn't have a strong arm and he's not the biggest quarterback. That's why he drops to the third round. But the Clawson thing still baffles me. And obviously it's individual preference. You know, Mike Holmgren didn't like him. didn't think he was a first or second round pick. The Buffalo Bills, they didn't think he was a first or second round pick. And once you get past those two teams, you know, you have some teams that were looking at quarterbacks, but they had other needs. Seattle was an example. Jacksonville was an example. And so you get that spot where, you know, after you get to a point in that round and everybody else has their quarterbacks, you're going to drop. And, you know, we have the dynamic now that most playoff teams all have elite quarterbacks. And so if you get into the bottom of a round, you're going to drop into the next round. And so then all of a sudden you start the process again. And if it's still no for Cleveland and Buffalo, it was pretty apparent he was going to fall down to Carolina, which, by the way, is not only great for Carolina, I think it's very good for Jimmy Clausen, because I think he gets a situation where he's got a running team, good coaching, and I think that, you know, this is a win-win, even though financially I counted that he lost at least $44 million and maybe in the max contract as much as, say, $56
million. You see, if he's listening, he doesn't want to hear that, John. He just turned the radio off going, oh, my God.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Roger Goodell noted this weekend, Roger Goodell was quoted as saying, I love Sam Bradford, the number one pick, and I hope he's great, but he probably made between $40 and $45 million. He's not even hit the field yet, and that's a guaranteed contract. Over the next 3 days, said Goodell, we'll give $600 million in guaranteed money to rookies. $300 million of that will probably not have a happy ending. I agree with Roger Goodell. We thought Brian Billick was a perfect person to bring on today because of this. He's a Fox analyst, former NFL head coach, Super Bowl Ravens. He has a book called More Than a Game. He addresses the future of the NFL, the business side of things. Brian is joining us. I almost feel like, Brian, the NFL loves parity, but the number one pick almost feels like a liability. Because you have to guarantee so much money, and now it almost feels like you have to draft a quarterback. Would you want the number one pick today, Brian?
You know, you can see why so many people talk about trading out of it. Imagine this conversation now. Steve Spagnuolo, Bill Devaney have to go to whoever the ownership of the St. Louis Rams is or is going to be. Say, you know what, we've got our guy, we've put our work in, we love Sam Bradford, you're going to have to give him, and I'll disagree a little bit with the commissioner, probably to take close to $50 million guaranteed money to sign him. And oh, by the way, he's got about a 50% chance of working out. That's a heck of a conversation in today's business world.
Well, and Brian, I wonder, I don't even like to talk about impending strikes, but it seems to me it's the overwhelming, glaring weakness of the league right now. It's not good for locker rooms. It forces teams compromising positions. How far do you believe the NFL would go to lower this cap? Is it a deal breaker?
No, I think this is one issue, and if you're talking about the rookie salaries, that both the league and the players can agree on. Now, I don't know that the union head, DeMora Smith, would say that necessarily. His predecessor obviously talked a great deal about we need to have the high rookie salaries to set the pay scale for the veterans. But most people will tell you that is, as well-meaning as our show was, that was not practical. So this is one issue. I think this will be a way, you know, the commissioner's got to find a way for DeMora Smith and the union to feel like they get a win. Because at the end of the day, the owners are going to get what they want. They are unified, new economic model. But by changing the rookie salary cap and diverting those monies more to the veteran, I think they can present this as a win for the union and the veteran players that will help us get to the point where hopefully we don't have a lockout.
Brian Billick joining us, The Herd on ESPN Radio, former NFL head coach with the Ravens, won a Super Bowl, now a Fox analyst. He is joining us via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. He has a book, More Than a Game, addressing the future of the NFL, including the business side of things. It is remarkable that the most talked about player in the first round, Brian, was Tim Tebow. And what's interesting about Tebow, more than ever, Brian, it's become a passing league. And nobody thinks that Tebow's a great pure passer. He may be a lot of things. It seems in this era of pure passing that Tebow's a real, real stretch for first round money. What did you make of it?
Well, I think it was obviously, I can't remember a player being talked about more in this regard than Tim Tebow. And we all said the same thing. You love the kid.
if there's a God above, this kid will be successful, because you want a young man like this to be successful. He is a freakish athlete, maybe the best player ever in college football. But those abilities, do they translate into the National Football League? His throwing style doesn't mean they can't. I mean, you can cut to the chase. You've followed the NFL for a long time. Who in the history of this league who's had any kind of success looks like this kid? I can't think of one. Now, that doesn't mean that can't happen. I think in order for him to be successful, and maybe he is the missing link, so to speak, the catalyst to push this league towards what has been evolving in college football for a number of years with this spread offense, maybe he fundamentally changes the league. I don't think he will, because it's, you know, if you're going to go to this style of play, you better have a couple Tim Tebows, because you're just not going to last in the NFL. You're going to take too many hits. Can he alter his throwing style and be successful? Maybe. I don't know that I've ever seen anybody make as big a change as Tim Tebow is going to have to make to be successful.
I said that I thought, to some degree, Ben Roethlisberger got Tim Tebow drafted in the first round. Character became such an overwhelming theme the last 2 weeks in the NFL, that character suddenly, I've never heard character being used more in a draft than this draft. Obviously, you want a locker room of mostly quality human beings. It's inexact. What do you make of the character stuff, Brian? Would you draft guys? What baggage would you draft? What, like Dez Bryant, what baggage do you draft? What baggage would Brian Billick not draft?
Well, I like what Ben Roethlisberger said a few years back about character, saying that to a player, you know, rhetorically, I'll tolerate you until I can replace you. And I've said for a long time, character is not a moral, ethical question in the National Football League. It's an economic question. You talk about character. Let's look at the Denver draft. And you're right. It is something that you hope is at the forefront. The top three players of their draft, people, off the charts, intelligent, good character. Parrish Cox in the fifth round has some real issues out of Oklahoma State. So you look at their draft, and as we did on Thursday and Friday, said, boy, this is their mantra, this is where they're going. Then you get to the fifth round, and you recognize, okay, for a fifth round, we'll take the chance. You know, the same young man. You know, he's still coming into your locker room, but obviously the fifth round is a lot easier way to stomach questions about character than it is first, second, third round, and the downside to that. So, and that young man may turn out just fine. So, you know, character in the league is important. Everybody wants intelligent, high-charactered individuals. But it's a sliding scale based on that ability and what they can do for your team.
Good talking to you, Brian. The book is More Than a Game. Thanks for stopping by, Coach.
Glad to do it.
You know, a lot of people are freaking out about the Lakers. And listen, you know, you watch them Saturday and they got crushed. And I said this on Thursday. I thought they were going to get killed Thursday night. They ended up getting killed over the weekend. They had a chance to win game three, which surprised me, but they got smoked. They did not meet the urgency of Oklahoma City. Rick Bucher from ESPN, the magazine, via the Subway Fresh Take hotline. Rick, I look at the fast break points here. Oklahoma City owns a whopping 72-17 edge in fast break points, mostly because the Lakers aren't fast anymore. How problematic is this for the Lakers?
It's very problematic because they don't have the speed in the backcourt, and they don't have the big men that they can consistently go to, that they can go to possession after possession to slow down the pace and make it a half-court game. Until they solve that, it's going to be a factor in the series. Now, teams don't generally run as well on the road as they do at home. So having the home court advantage is still an advantage. And the fact that the Oklahoma City Thunder have never closed out a series, and that's a whole different ball of wax. That's another level to go to.
Yeah.
But those are the things that the Lakers are hanging their hat on right now.
Could you make an argument, Rick, that the Lakers are actually getting a break outside of this series because Utah's beating a more athletic Denver, and
yep,
and veteran, slower, cagier San Antonio's beating more athletic Dallas? And after this series, if the Lakers get through, they'll face,
yep,
teams that look more like they do.
Yep, no question about it. It sounds strange to have a neophyte team, the eighth seed first round, but this could be the most challenging matchup that the Lakers have because, between Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, I don't know that they're going to face a combination that athletic, that matches up at their weak points. But let's not take away from the Thunder front line of, I mean, they're no names. They're not supposed to be anybody, but Serge Ibaka, Nenad Krstić, Nick Collison, these guys are, I don't care what the numbers say, they are having an impact because they're not allowing Pau Gasol and Andrew Bynum to dominate this series the way that they should.
Well, Kobe's finger's clearly an issue. You don't go from being the best closer in the game a month and a half ago to how he's shooting. Did the Lakers make a mistake and not rest him and not get surgery and not fix this?
Well, it's always up to the player. And look, he's done it before. He's played through it before. So it's awfully hard at this stage to tell Kobe to shut it down or to tell him what he needs to do to protect his body. And I don't know. I'm not sure that as far as the finger is concerned, I really don't think that that's the major issue. As ungainly as it looks, and I don't know about you, Colin, but I'm trying to imagine shooting an NBA game with my index finger on my shooting hand wrapped like a sausage. The degree of difficulty there, it just seems off the charts. I believe that this has a lot more to do with his legs because he's not getting to the free throw line the way we expect. If he was getting there and he was shooting 50-60%, that would be one thing. But he's not shooting. He's not getting to the free throw line. And to me, that means that he's not beating the defender to the angles and forcing that guy to foul him. And that, to me, has a lot more to do with legs than it has to do with his finger.
I still think that the Lakers veterans will close out the series. Do you?
I do, but for those two reasons that I mentioned, that they have the home court, and that closing out a playoff series, and we saw New Orleans with San Antonio a couple years ago, and they had home advantage. They had game seven on their home floor, if I'm not mistaken. And you could just see that young team was suddenly, you know, they're just playing, they're running up and down, and it was like, holy cow, we could knock out the Spurs.
Yeah.
What do we do now?
That's right.
I have to expect that dawning is going to have an impact. But I will say this, the Oklahoma City Thunder are not going away, and this could not be a greater experience. If they were playing like a Utah to seven or – you know, almost any other team, but being able to play, to come away from this series, win or lose, and say, we played the defending champions, and what we did was against Kobe Bryant and the defending champions, that's going to serve them well down the line.
Rick Bucher, it's The Herd on ESPN Radio. I saw a dunk yesterday, and for the record, I like the Spurs over the Mavs. I took the Celtics over Miami. I like old veteran teams. I like the Lakers. But I got to touch on LeBron. Yeah, I've never thought of LeBron as Michael Jordan, as a skill set. But he had a dunk yesterday against the Bulls that was so ferocious. And I sat there and I thought, he is so confident physically. It was one of the first times I looked at LeBron and thought, he would give Jordan issues. He's so powerful. He's a defensive end who dunks.
Physically, we've never seen anything like LeBron. Imagine Karl Malone being able to come at you like Allen Iverson. That's what you're dealing with. he's so quick and he's so proportionally built that you don't think of it. But that's 275 pounds, 6'9", coming at you and has, you know, with the ball, may have the quickest, maybe one of the most quick technical players in the league. I don't even know. I was sitting around with some scouts the other night, and we were talking about it. It's like when you have that freight train coming at you that fast, you can't even hope to wrap up his arms or foul him and think it's going. You're a bug on the windshield.
Yeah.
No. I mean, Jordan was magnificent because in his era, for his size, the physicality at the rim. Nobody went off 1 foot. You had to go off 2 feet, or you were going to get knocked into the stands. And that he played through that, and he was as dominant around the rim, says something about his tenacity and his fearlessness. Think about this. He was giving away at least 50 pounds and 3 inches to LeBron James.
I saw that dunk yesterday against the Bulls, and I thought, I've never seen a player who dunks like that. The ferocity, the velocity. It's just incredible. Rick Bucher joining us. Still likes the Lakers. Hanging on. Good talking to you, Bukes.
You got it.
And we're very pleased to welcome in our buddy John Kruk from Baseball Tonight on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Krucky joins us every Monday at this time. How are you, John?
Well, I'm good. I thought you were calling me the professor. I heard the professor John. I'm thinking, God, they finally got it right.
I would be pleased. What would you be a professor of?
Well, obviously not USC or Notre Dame.
Yeah.
A professor in your own right when you wear the glasses.
I mean, very disappointing in you, Golic. Very disappointing that you would succumb to wearing a jersey of the enemy.
Well, listen, if you make a wager, you have to pay up, don't you? I mean, you wouldn't welsh on a bet, would you?
Well, in that case, yes. I think I would. And who are you betting against?
That's very good. John Kruk with us here on Mike and Mike. Okay, you can help us with this because we're sitting and we are watching these numbers. John Lester is 0-2. His ERA is over 6. Justin Verlander hasn't won a game this year. His ERA is almost 7. Jake Peavy's ERA is 7.5. Gavin Floyd's ERA is over 8. These pitchers are get off to slow starts. Do you worry about them? Are they going to get it together? What's happening?
I worry more. I would, if I'm the White Sox, I would more worry more about Peavy and Gavin Floyd than Lester and Verlander. Just for the simple fact that Peavy's coming off injury, had a handful of starts, 2 or 3 starts last year at the end of the season for the White Sox after the trade. He would be the one I would be more concerned with. Gavin Floyd is he's a guy that just worries you. You know, in Philadelphia, he was awful. They thought he was going to be the savior there, and he was awful. And he found a new home in Chicago, pitched well. But, you know, has always had bouts of inconsistency, and hopefully I think for Ozzie and the White Sox, this is his bout of inconsistency for this year, is the first month of the season. Lester, I can't explain. The stuff's there. When you're watching pitch, it's the stuff's there. It's just, it seems like now, like last year, if he made a mistake, it was a foul ball. Now they make a mistake, it's a double in the gap, and that's killing him.
You know, we talk about teams that are we project to do well this year that start out slow and say, well, it's early, and they have time to build themselves back up. But how about teams that are playing well out of the gate, like a San Diego, in a way that how well you think they can sustain and stay up near the top as opposed to the teams that aren't doing so well?
Well, we got chastised last year by Heath Bell, the closer of the Padres, because he didn't think we were giving him enough credit and enough respect. And, you know, when you look at the lineup through and through, their starting rotation through and through, first of all, you don't know half the guys. Second of all, you know, you don't know if they can play 162-game schedule compete. And obviously last year they did fall off. I don't know if this is going to be any different. I think when you have so many young players on a team, so many young pitchers especially, it's tough to get to. You can go out, you know, you can talk to minor league guys and everything. What's this guy throw? Until you've seen him a couple times, you really don't have any idea of what he does. And this young pitching staff, you know, they're pitching great right now. How are they going to do, though, in June, July, and August when, okay, now everyone has the book on there, I'll have a scouting report, how are we going to do? Because none of them are like flamethrowers, throwing 95, you know, 98, just blowing people away. So I think it's going to be an interesting I hold off on the San Diego Padres until June. And then if they're still hanging around in June, then I might say, okay, now they have something. But it's too early now because they did the same thing last year.
Mike and John Kruk, a team that I think will be hanging around in June, led by a young pitcher that we've been waiting to see emerge in this way, is Tampa Bay. They're very good, and David Price suddenly is tremendous. How do you hit that guy?
Well, I probably would have asked for that day off. It wouldn't have been a lot of fun for a lefty, but, you know, we knew it was just a matter of time, you know, to harness the control because that was his big issue. You know, get behind hitters, not being able to finish guys off, you know, walking too many guys. And when you put that many guys on base and you're constantly pitching from the stretch, you're going to give up a lot of runs, and not a lot of runs, but more runs than he should. what we saw yesterday that was pretty dominating. I mean, it was to talk about a team that had no chance. I mean, they had Toronto had no chance, and Toronto can hit. And then he just buried those guys. It was, I mean, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about the second coming of John Lester or not, but this kid could be as good as any of them pretty soon.
So 17 to 19 games in, what has surprised you the most in a good way about this season?
Well, even though Kansas City's in last place, the fact that they're one of the top hitting teams in all of baseball, at least now you know that they're trying to go in the right direction. Granky's not doing as well as everyone thought. And what I like also is the fact that every division's close. I mean, there's not like a team that's just running away with something and the other teams really stink. I thought the Cardinals might have that chance, but, you know, all the other teams are sticking close now. Houston's starting to win games, and they're coming on in that division. And if they have a second half like they always do, you know, a big second half, who knows what can happen in Houston. And I think that's what I like. The more teams that are in it, it's the better for us on baseball tonight because we get to talk about more teams instead of just, you know, the Yankees, Red Sox, and the Cardinals and the Phillies and all those other teams.
He is John Kruk. He is the professor of baseball, and he joins us every Monday here on Mike and Mike. Thanks, Kruk.
Hey, no problem. Hey, I'm a Carolina fan. If you ever see me somewhere, something Duke Greeny, go with both of you. Have permission. Anyone that works ESPN, punch me in the mouth.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I'll do that. No problem.
Fair enough. There's John Kruk.